Hold to order. Let's start with a roll call.
Allison,
is that you? Oh, we're pausing for just a moment.
Rodney Rutherford.
Here.
Angela Rosman.
Here.
Aaron Jacobson.
Here.
Gina Medea.
Here.
Julia Nolan.
Here.
Scott Reiser.
And with that, with the majority of commissioners present, we have a quorum and may conduct business. Next item on the agenda is items from the audience. This is the portion of the meeting where we hear from the public about items that are not scheduled for public hearing. Tonight's public hearing is about miscellaneous code amendments and co-living housing, zoning, and municipal code amendments. If you'd like to address the commission at this time, not about the public hearing, please raise your hand. And if you're participating remotely, you can press the raise hand button to indicate your interest in speaking at this time. And I don't think we have any sign-ins here. And seeing no hands, then we can proceed. This is just for items that are not on the public hearing. And so with that, next item on the agenda is special presentations. There are none. Next item is study session. There is none. And we're on to public hearings. The first public hearing is the 2025 Miscellaneous Code Amendments. And I hereby open this public hearing.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So we're going to pull up your presentation here. You first received a briefing on this one back in July. We're bringing it back for public hearing tonight. There's been a little bit of a staff change around here, so I am not Peter, but credit to Peter Milliken for his good work on this project, and I'm just getting it through the finish line with y'all tonight and then at council. So for the public hearing, we'll have the staff presentation. Planning Commission is welcome to ask any questions you might have to clarify staff's recommendation to you. Before opening it up for public testimony, after you receive public testimony, if you're ready, you can deliberate and make your recommendation to City Council. So I'm going to be brief tonight. Please feel free to stop me if you want more detail on anything. Generally, to remind both you and any members of the community watching, what are miscellaneous code amendments? This is an annual package of code amendments that we bring you, and they're typically reflective of clarifications, things with very little to no policy impact. Oftentimes they are slight edits to maintain consistency with other regulations, to clarify maybe something that we found in practice could be better described in the code, and in certain cases, including this year, also to codify policy direction from City Council. That's the one we'll spend just a little bit of time on tonight. So this package is really split up into three buckets of code amendments. The first are really just those clarifying ministerial inconsistency amendments. So these are ones where maybe we referenced a section one inadvertently and it should have been a section two. We went over these with you in July. I'm happy to answer any questions about them. The one item in this list of the really minor bucket that I do want to point out to you, just because we didn't mention it to you back in July, it is new since July, is item 16. This was included in your packet, and this is reinstating some development standards for the RH1B zone that were inadvertently repealed. So with the station area rezones, there were two parcels that were in the RH1B zone that were not rezoned to a station area zone. So we do need that section of the code reinstated to make sure we have development standards for those parcels. There have been no changes made to those development standards, so just a reinstatement. Moving on to the second group of miscellaneous code amendments, this is the council-directed policy change. There's only one item in this bucket, and that's related to how artificial turf gets counted or exempted towards the maximum lot coverage allowed on sites. Council directed us to prepare a draft code amendment that increased the exemption percentage of artificial turf from 50% to 70%. That will essentially, in practice, increase the flexibility for artificial turf when it's installed on sites because more of it will be exempt towards the maximum lot coverage. Last time we came and talked to you, you had mentioned it might be helpful to get a little bit of a diagram of how we calculate lot coverage on a site. This is an example of a low-density residential parcel and the things on the site that we're counting towards lot coverage. So there's, in most of these sites throughout the city, low-density residential zones, they have a maximum lot coverage of 50%. So you can't cover more than 50% of the site. Most items are non-exempt materials, so 100% of their area counts towards that lot coverage. And that's things like building footprints, driveways, walkways, things like that. And then we have a group of materials that are partially exempt, so only a portion of their area counts towards lot coverage. And that's things like pavers. So if pavers are installed and they're spaced out a certain distance, those are exempt at 50% of their area. And turf, for the past several years, has also been one of those items that's partially exempt. Only 50% of its area counts towards the maximum lot coverage. So in this specific instance, there was 416 square feet of turf on this site. Only 208 square feet of it counted towards lot coverage. So that's what has been regulated for turf the past few years since Planning Commission recommended and Council adopted counting giving turf any type of exemption. Prior to 2019, it counted at 100%. It's been at 50% since 2019, and tonight you're considering a draft code amendment that would increase its exemption from 50% to 75%. This is the only text I have planned to show you within this presentation. I just wanted to show you how we accomplished that in the code. So this is the draft code language. This is an excerpt from the lot coverage section of our code. There's a list of partially exempt materials. Staff's recommendation to accomplish the council direction is to just create a new section with 75% exempt materials, of which there's only one. That would be artificial turf. Based on the conversation that Planning Commission had when we briefed you on this item, there was an interest in clarifying how this or maybe clarifying ways that we could make sure that we're still respecting our tree code, our critical areas ordinance, and the like. And so staff also added this sentence that you'll see in section I, subsection I after artificial turf, just making sure that anyone reading this section of code knows that you also need to look at our tree code, our Homes Point overlay code, our critical area ordinance, and our shoreline code, to make sure that you're also reading those sections, because those code sections don't allow turf anywhere on the lot. There's some further restrictions. So just adding, again, not new regulations, but just a code reference to make sure that's clear to folks when they're looking at the section. Moving on to the last bucket of miscellaneous code amendments. This year, these are all about state legislation implementation, and so many of these are in our municipal code. I'm going to breeze through them. Again, please stop me if you have any questions. We did go over all of these with you in July. So these are all intended to implement state legislation, as we're required to do. The first is updating our definition of a project permit. This is going to help implement a House bill that gives us some implementation or some review timelines. Pardon me. The second is a clarification of what is allowed to be sort of divided through binding site plans, and that commercially zoned properties includes commercially zoned properties with mixed use or residential uses on them. There's a third item and a fourth item that both have to do with updating SEPA categorical exemption thresholds. So that was some legislation at the state intended to streamline residential permitting a bit more. And I think this is the last one. This one is adding definitions for specific types of housing into our code. So this is actually following up on a comment we got back after the adoption of our comprehensive plan from the State Department of Commerce, wanting us to have explicit definitions for these types of housing in our code. This amendment doesn't change how we regulate any of these housing types. It just gives us a definition for them all. Oh, and sorry, one more. That is state legislation implementation, and this is adding more flexibility for building conversions when things are converting from commercial or office into residential. So there's a new section of the code that will give us a little bit of clarity for that. And with that, just next steps, you're holding the public hearing tonight. If Planning Commission is able to reach a recommendation to the council, staff is tentatively planning to take this package of miscellaneous code amendments to council on September 16th for them to consider adoption. And with that, I will kick it over to the Planning Commission with any questions before you receive public testimony.
All right. Any commissioners with questions?
I could have missed it, but I thought in our packet there was reference to an updated SEPA analysis before the 28th meeting.
Yes, so any time that we amend the zoning code, we are required to evaluate it through a SEPA determination, and we did issue a SEPA addendum for this one. And it was issued after your packet was published, but before tonight, so it was published sometime last week. And that SEPA addendum is basically the city's determination that the code amendments in this package are consistent with the SEPA analysis that we've done to date. In this case, the latest being our supplemental environmental impact statement that we completed for the comprehensive plan. It is, yes, and we can send you a direct link if you want.
All right. Any further questions? Seeing no questions. I had a question. I was trying to figure out what's the intended purpose or benefit of the lot coverage regulations, and I want to make sure that I understand that before we work through possibilities of changing it. And what I'm not clear on is, are there parts that this specifically addresses that are not covered in other parts of the code, such as drainage, stormwater? It sounds like we already have other stormwater regulations, so that should be covered there. I would wonder, like, are there perhaps regulations in other parts of the code that reference the amount of pervious land area on the lot and build regulations based or requirements based on the amount of permeable surface, so like vegetation requirements that are results from permeable surface or something like that. I don't know. Is that something that you can provide guidance on?
Yeah, I'll take a stab at it. So lot coverage used to be a little bit more intertwined with our stormwater or impervious surface calculations, and the code amendments that Planning Commission worked on in 2019 really sought to decouple those things as separate calculations for different purposes. So we do have stormwater regulations. We comply with King County Stormwater Manual, and that's actually tied to our, we have an environmental permit from the state that regulates how we treat water as it runs off of hard surfaces in the city and how it might impact streams and wetlands, another topic that you're talking about right now. So the stormwater calculations are really looking at the actual water permeability into the site. And the interesting thing, or I find it interesting about stormwater, is that you can actually meet our stormwater requirements with a lot of pretty hardscape surfaces. So you can actually pave a lot of the site, and as long as you're treating the water, you might be able to meet the stormwater regulations, because it's really about cleaning the water and making sure that the water's not running through or off the site so quickly that we're causing erosion. And I'm sure there's other impacts that our stormwater engineers could tell you more about. Whereas lot coverage traditionally here, and I think in other cities as well, is a little bit more of a hardscape versus landscaping or softscape on any given property. And so we have lower lot coverage maximums in our low density residential areas, and typically higher lot coverage allowances in our commercial areas where we expect more of the lot to be paved or covered with a building. And so really our lot coverage regulation right now is about that hardscape versus softscape on the site. So it does leave more room to meet our landscaping requirements. In our low density residential areas, we don't have landscaping requirements beyond tree requirements. So we have a minimum number of trees on site, but we don't have landscaping requirements beyond that like we do in some of our commercial areas. Our commercial areas, we have a little bit more design or landscaping regulations about buffering parking lots, having landscaping along the edges of the property and also regulating and requiring landscaping beyond trees. So we're a little more prescriptive in our low density zones. We have lot coverage maximums, which means there's a good portion of the site available for that type of softscape, but people have more choice in what they do with it.
Okay, thank you for clarifying it. So it sounds like largely the lot coverage requirements, especially in, well, perhaps even in most areas, is arguably redundant. And what you're describing makes me, to understand like the nuance you're getting at, it sounds like it might be a matter of aesthetics or perhaps heat island effects that might not be addressed elsewhere in the code. Is that perhaps the remaining significance of lot coverage requirements?
I think it's fair to say that that's two of the primary.
Okay. Okay. All right. Okay. Thank you. Any further questions? Commissioner Medea?
It's not about the lot coverage, but about the KZC 5.10 housing definitions and the transitional housing, emergency housing, and permanent supportive housing. There's language in there that says it leaves unchanged the review and approval process for those housing types. Mm-hmm. So what does that mean in terms of the public impact and opportunity for input?
Yeah, so again, this code amendment isn't changing any of that, but generally those housing types are already allowed anywhere that we allow hotels or motels. And most of those uses are, I'm thinking through our commercial areas, some of those commercial areas would require at least design review in addition to building permits. The design review process right now, another thing that we're having to amend to meet state requirements, right now the design review process includes public meetings, usually more than one, and those provide opportunity for public comment. Our building permit processes, we hear from people about them, but there's not a formal public comment process as part of those building permit reviews. So some commercial areas would require at least design review. Other commercial areas for those types of uses would just be building permits or construction permits.
Is there a notice to the public if that's the type of housing that's going to go in an area?
Right now, if it's allowed by right, the building permit process does not include a public notice requirement. It is publicly available information.
All right. I think we can proceed on to the next. What's next?
Public testimony.
All right. Sounds good. We have three people signed in for testimony on this topic, and I see one also participant online. So I will provide a quick orientation on how this will work. In order to hear from as many people as possible tonight, we are allowing any individual wishing to provide comments to speak for a maximum of 3 minutes. The timer on the lectern will flash a yellow light when 30 seconds remain and a red light when your time is ended. To be fair to all speakers, we will adhere strictly to the 3-minute limit. The Commission wants to hear from as many different views and opinions as possible. If you have already heard another speaker state your comment, please consider not repeating the comment and instead provide a comment or perspective that is unique to you. In making your comments, we ask that you please redirect them to the Commission, but this is not a time for give and take with the Commission. Obscene, profane, threatening, harassing, or abusive language toward the Commission, city staff, or those in the audience are not allowed. As audience members, please refrain from any demonstrative agreement or disagreement with a speaker, such as clapping, cheering, or booing. These actions are not only disruptive, they may also intimidate or have the effect of excluding others in the community whose views may differ. We'll begin items from the audience with a list of people here in person that have signed up to speak, and so when I call your name, please approach the dais to address us. Online audience members may indicate that you wish to speak by raising your hand in the Zoom meeting now. When it is your turn to speak, we will admit you into the virtual room as a panelist. Please remain muted until I call your name, and then you may unmute to address the commission. So the first person on the list is Stephen Crane, and I'd also invite staff to add Jessica to cue Jessica up as the next speaker. Go ahead.
Good evening. Thank you, commissioners, for the opportunity to speak. My name is Stephen Crane. I am an attorney, and I represent Tim and Melissa Yeh, who are the homeowners in City of Kirkland who received a notice of infraction from the city for a violation of the civil violation regarding lot coverage, which has already been addressed as an issue that is on the agenda today. I will speak briefly and then turn the microphone. Oh, I believe the next person up is Mr. Yeh. And then thirdly, there's a third person, Alan Bennett, who was the installer, whose company installed the artificial turf at issue here. The first thing I want to note is that I will not be addressing and I'll leave that for my client, the community issues that he sees in the neighborhood when he walks around the neighborhood and he sees other homes with artificial turf and is wondering, you know, why he received the notice that he received and the other neighbors did not, to the best of his knowledge. Some maybe did, but certainly not all the people who have artificial turf. So it seems kind of like a selective targeting for whatever reason. Maybe it's based on complaints. Maybe it's based on a drive-by. We don't know. Then the second person who'll speak after me is Alan Bennett. He's with Grassland Synthetic Turf, and they're the company that installs artificial turf in Kirkland and other jurisdictions for homeowners. And he will be speaking better than I could on the properties of the materials that they use, how it's installed, why it is environmentally more friendly to the homeowner and for the community to use it instead of actually actual grass. It has definite benefits for that. I handed up to the staff who distributed to you, I believe, my printed comments and my proposed amendments. I have 30 seconds left. I'll just make the point that there's only two proposed amendments. They're pretty simple. It's adding the term artificial turf as an exempt material, and then it's deleting the reference to it as a partially exempt material, since it's not going, if you approve the first one, it would not need to be or inappropriate to be in the other one. Thank you for your consideration of my written presentation, and I look forward to your decision. Thank you.
Thank you. We have queued up Jessica, I believe, as the next speaker, and then we'll return to the speakers in the room. Yes.
Good evening, commissioners. Thank you, Chair. And thank you, commissioners. I'm Jessica Rowe, land use attorney with McCullough Hill. I'm speaking here tonight on behalf of the Reevey family, who are a single-family homeowner in Kirkland. Their home is on Northeast 90th Street. I just wanted to give some background on the genesis of this code amendment that was brought forth by Councilmember Tin Chisholm, which is the Reeveys are a typical homeowner who have, well, I don't know if it's typical, but their lot is 8,000 square feet, but it's typical in the sense that their house takes up about half of the lot, more than 49%. So the result is that the 50% lot coverage limit means they cannot have any turf even in their backyard. So that's how all of this came about, because grass does not grow in their backyard. They've tried all kinds of things, and I spoke to the owner today and some trees died as well recently. So what they would like is a minimal amount of turf in the backyard where no one can see it. And they've got kids who run around, and they don't want the kids running around on rocks and mud. So just a really practical explanation of why this came about. But also we do think it seems to apply to a lot of people. And we thought it would be a logical progression of the code, given the things that you, Chair, were talking about and staff about. Impervious surface, critical areas, shorelines, all the other things that regulate lot coverage to do this. The thing that I will say to you tonight is that the 75% exemption, while it we appreciate it and it sounds great, won't actually allow any more turf, maybe like 1 square foot more or even less than that as a practical matter in this instance. And it may be the case in a lot of other instances as well, given that a house may be pretty close to the lot coverage limit. So if it should be allowed as a policy matter, which we do think it should be, we'd support the amendments that Mr. Kramer submitted, or alternatively, like a de minimis exemption if it's not visible from the street of 1,200 square feet, just to allow homeowners to do this, you know, in their backyard if they would like to, so long as they meet all the other code requirements. And we definitely support staff's suggestion to have the reference to the other parts of the code, because we understand critical areas, shoreline, all that stuff still applies. So that is our friendly amendment suggestion, just to have the practical intent of the code amendment be more effective. Thank you for the time tonight.
Thank you, Jessica. Next one on the list is Alan Bennett, although I think I heard there's maybe a mutual preference for Tim Yeh to go first. Is that correct? Okay.
Good evening, committee. My name is Tim Yeh, and I'm here tonight to ask you to reconsider how artificial turf is treated under Kirkland's lot coverage rules. Currently, turf is only at 50% exemption, and I urge you to make that 100% because artificial turf is not an impervious surface, and treating it as such is both unfair and unsupported by the science. First, the practical reality. Requiring residents to remove turf installations can cost families more than $130,000, and this is simply just not feasible. And yet, enforcement has been inconsistent. I've counted at least a dozen or so homes around my neighborhood that also have turf, and yet they have not been asked to remove it. It feels pretty arbitrary and unfair to target some families while others are not held to the same standard. Second, many concerns about turf are based on outdated or incomplete research. Modern systems are nothing like a slab of concrete. Professionally installed turf built on permeable gravel base with drainage layers. In fact, infiltration rates are measured between 4 to 20 inches per hour, often exceeding the performance of natural lawns, especially in Kirkland's clay-heavy soils. Turf also requires no irrigations, fertilizers, or pesticides, which means cleaner stormwater, healthier lakes, and significant water conservation at a time when summers are becoming hotter and drier, just like today. Third, this is about the quality of life for families. Children should be able to enjoy the freedom of playing outside year-round without worrying about muddy ground or ruined grass after every rainfall. Turf provides that consistency and usability, something natural lawns can't offer in many shaded or high-use areas. Fourth, there's clear precedent. Kirkland itself has installed synthetic turf in public spaces because it's safe, functional, and environmentally sound. In fact, turf is being used in the Totem Lake Park, the 132nd Square Park redevelopment. It's being installed in school fields like Lake Washington High School, Lakeview Elementary School field upgrade as well. If turf is safe enough for our schools and playgrounds where toddlers and students play daily, then it should be safe enough for families as well. Finally, Kirkland is just falling behind its neighbors. The city of Kenmore, in its code, explicitly does not consider turf an impervious surface. The city of Sammamish, as well, does not consider turf as an impervious surface either. Redmond, the way they calculate it, is they classify artificial turf as pervious when it infiltrates to native soil and only treats it as impervious or a hard surface when there's an underdrain that conveys flow to the system. Our installation mirrors the permeable pavement pathway recognized by the ecology and is functionally pervious. This is a regional trend in sustainable planning that Kirkland should be a part of and not opposed to. Commissioners, this is about fairness, science, and the freedom for families to enjoy their own yard safely and sustainably. Artificial turf is not an impervious surface. It's a solution that saves water, protects the environments, and improves quality of life. Let's make Kirkland a leader in smart, family-friendly policy and not a city that punishes it. I respectfully urge you to exempt artificial turf 100% from lot coverage. Thank you.
Thank you, Tim. Next is Alan Bennett.
Good evening, y'all. My name is Alan Bennett with Grassland Synthetic Turf. I've been in the industry for about 3 years. Our technicians have been installing forever, over 7 years with artificial turf. With turf itself, for the drainage system, it actually drains about exactly what Tim said. It's about 4 to 20 inches per hour. With sand and topsoil, their actual drainage is about 0.8 inches or up to the low as 0.2 inches per hour. So with the drainage system with turf itself, It is very permeable, and it'll be able to just drain straight down. We dig out probably about between 4 to 5 inches of the existing soil so that we can get through all that compacted dirt that's been with new homes, that with all the heavy machinery, so that it can get flowed straight down to the actual drainage system so that it would be able to have no issues with any of the water itself. And then, let's see. For new products that are leading, they're lead-free, pet-safe, and they're designed to minimize wear. Using Green Diamond infilled sand helps with the filtration system through the water and then to the drainage rocks and then be able to just flow through the system with no issues at all. Other than that, like I said, we've been installing turf all the way down to Lacey, and we have gone all the way up to Marysville, and we've probably done about 72 customers this year in every different counties, and we try to follow, or we do follow, as far as anything that is from the water buffering to whatever city regulations are. So the only one is that permeable it is definitely. So that's all I have.
Thank you, Alan.
All right, thank you.
All right, are there any other participants in the online audience who would like to speak, or anyone in person? Liz, do you want to come forward?
Good evening, commissioners and staff. I couldn't find the sign-up sheet when I was 3 minutes late, so sorry. Thank you. My name's Liz Hunt. I'm a resident of Kirkland. I wanted to speak to some of the miscellaneous code amendments. Overall, I think the amendments proposed make sense. I do have a few comments and questions. Three. The first one is KMC 2402065, which is talking about SEPA review and omitting SEPA review in some additional situations, which do not occur today. It would allow more projects to omit the SEPA environmental review, for example, converting a building to from commercial to residential use and increasing the density up to 50% would not require the SEPA review, and a new residential development in the station area. There's another item which is also allowing increased exemptions from concurrency, and that's things like traffic studies, and also converting commercial properties to residential, making that easier. All of those things will help encourage more residential units, which I know we're working hard for. My questions are, what are the impacts of removing those potential mitigations? Have we thought about that when you're removing these reviews? And also the potential loss of commercial property when we're converting some to residential. Have we thought about how much might be converted, and do we really have the extra commercial properties available for that purpose? My second comment is about the permanent supportive housing and transitional housing definitions. And I appreciated the comment from Commissioner Medea about these items are being proposed now to be allowed by right, so in a residential area. So permanent supportive housing like La Quinta would be allowed in a residential area without any special noticing to the public and any special review. I think we really need to consider changing that, because these are constructions that, these are developments that require services to help these folks get through the situations that they're in, and it's a different scenario than just another house going in next door to you. The third item is signs, and I'm out of time here almost. KZC 115-11. Would that allow neon signs and the insides of windows of individual businesses? I'm starting to see those popping up around town, and they're starting to be problematic. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Liz. All right. I don't think we have any further interested speakers, so... Do we have Oh, and we have, yeah, is that a question from Aaron or?
Mr. Chair, I believe we had someone who has already moved to the panelists.
Oh, okay. All right. Is that right? Okay. All right. Thank you. Is that Shale? Okay. All right. Shale, you can go ahead and speak to the commission and introduce yourself first, last name. Although we can't yet hear you. Nothing yet. They're on, they're a panelist. And it doesn't appear they're muted on Zoom. Now they're muted. Oh, maybe audio hadn't joined and now they're muted. And now maybe if they click unmute, it'll work. Yes, we can hear something. Can you introduce yourself and then your 3 minutes will begin?
Good afternoon. My name is Adam Mearson. My wife and I, we live in Kirkland. My wife does have a daycare and we are limited to a 12 children capacity. I know there is some work in the progress to increase the capacity for residential, for low density residential family childcare providers to increase to 16. We just wanted to see if that is what the projected time for these changes would be and how would that affect our planning for our future daycare project that we have in-house.
I'm thinking there's nothing in the current amendments for that, so we should probably address that outside of the hearing. Is that right?
Sure.
Oh, there is an item. Oh, there is an item. Okay. All right. Thank you. There is an item. So, yeah, we can take a closer look at that. Anything else?
Not at the moment. Thank you.
Thank you. All right. I think that's now everyone. All right. Great. So with that, I think we move on to deliberation amongst the commission. Is that right?
Yes, and happy to answer any questions that the commission has.
All right, and I guess I should close the testimony, the public testimony. All right, public testimony is closed. Commissioners, who would like to address the commission first? Commissioner Nolan?
I just had a question as far as for the artificial turf. At least a lot of what I read online, and this was a fairly brief search, was not particularly positive regarding its effects, both for heat island effects, volatile organic chemicals, plastic runoff, and then also limiting the runoff of water. But it does sound like there's some very substantial differences in the types available on the market. So I was curious whether it might make sense if we do make amendments to allow either a 75% exemption or potentially even be, you know, more so, if there might be some interest or appetite for stating that potentially certain types don't get the exemption, whereas ones that potentially, you know, do allow more drainage, you know, have been shown to not use lead, volatile organic chemicals that might fray less and therefore release less microplastics into our water streams, et cetera, et cetera. Might get the exemption while others didn't. I don't know.
Commissioner Jacobson?
Thank you. I have some questions to staff based on the comments. First question on the permanent supportive housing and other similar uses definitions. Am I correct in remembering that it's state law that requires that we treat those uses the same as hotels and stacked residential uses, and that's why we can't have any additional review processes?
That's correct. They have to be treated the same. So, but it doesn't allow a hotel scale to go into a zone that doesn't allow a hotel scale.
In layman's terms, if you were going to put permanent supportive housing in a low-density residential zone, it would have to be in the size of a single-family home, which is just, practically speaking, I don't think will ever happen, because we're not. It doesn't allow you to do that difference in scale, right?
That's correct, and I would just note that any of the housing typologies that are allowed in our low-density residential zones.
Okay. Then on the SEPA, I think there's a few parts to SEPA exemptions. The first one, the SEPA threshold exemption based on project size, that's just aligning with new state law. Is that right?
That's correct. And then I would note that at least in the station area, in the Northeast 85th Street station area, we do have a planned action ordinance. So the SEPA analysis has already been front loaded in those cases.
Okay. And then for the commercial, the conversion from commercial and the exemption from concurrency, again, that's dealing with state requirements.
Correct.
And then kind of above all of that, if I remember correctly, these SEPA exemptions only apply if the proposed project is compliant with the existing zoning and comprehensive plan.
I would need to double check that, but that sounds right.
Okay.
The exemptions are limited in that case.
Okay. From what I remember on the threshold bill, that required zoning, compliance with zoning. And of course, our zoning policies are not, changing the zoning is not exempt from SEPA analysis. So we're still doing the SEPA analysis. It's just, it's happening at the time of setting zoning, not happening at the time of setting zoning, and then again at the individual project level.
That's correct.
Cool. And then I believe that was all I had. Thank you.
Commissioner Rosman.
So for starters, could you comment on the note or the comment that one of the public commenters had on the neon signs inside businesses?
So this would clarify that items within the business wouldn't be regulated under the sign code, including the neon signs.
Okay, thank you. And then otherwise, could you also explain the like 12 to 16 child thing for the child care update? Just because other than that, I think the only comments I have are on the turf and everything else I'm good with. So I figured it might be easiest to get everything else out of the way and then finish up with the turf.
Right. Thank you for the question. So for the size of child care homes allowed, so there's actually a state waiver available for that that people can already take advantage of. So it's really a cleanup item in our code because our code has a student limitation set in the definition, and we find it appropriate to reference the state waiver possible. So if someone were to receive the waiver from the state to expand the size of their child care home, we would still be required to regulate it as the family child care home. So people can already do it. This is really just adding a reference to clarify how we relate to the state code.
Okay. And then just for the listeners, that means that when we pass this and it goes to city council and city council passes these amendments, then that'll be done, but it doesn't actually materially change what someone is able to do right now.
Correct. The state waiver is already available.
Okay. All right, now on to turf. Specifically, I want to start by saying, actually, the fact that I'm hearing that quite a few homes have quite a bit of turf, to me, makes this actually a, like, higher focus item than less. If it was just a couple of homes, I think maybe we could treat it differently. But at the point we have a lot of homes in a neighborhood with a lot of artificial turf, the comments around especially plastics runoff feels like something we really should pay attention to, as well as heat island. Pervious surface and lot coverage is not just about drainage. It's also about heat island. It's also about having like natural areas within our city. So I want to be really careful that we don't approve something just because it sounds like it's not that big of a deal when if we have whole neighborhoods like this, it actually does become a larger deal. That said, I also wonder if there's some way to talk about, you know, depending on plastic runoff and that sort of thing, but to treat the like heat island and natural spaces, I wonder if there's like almost like a fee in lieu option where homeowners could pay into like a parks fund in exchange for having more lot coverage with turf. But that's still, microplastics are a big deal, especially indoor waterways. And even if it drains the same, that doesn't mean that it is a natural material. So I think that's it.
Any further comments? Medea?
Yeah, I mean, that definitely some issues to think through in terms of the long-term impact as more and more of that becomes utilized. I am curious about Kenmore Redmond and Sammamish, that one of the speakers referenced as their code being modified to allow more exemptions in that space. Do we know, is that also as part of their recent comprehensive plan updates that that topic was undertaken, or how long has that been in effect for those cities?
I don't know the answer to that. I will say that it's a pretty specific and discrete item to be talking about during a comprehensive plan review.
Yeah, yeah.
So in my professional opinion, I'd be surprised if they talked about it. It also might be worth noting, just as a reminder to the commission, that when the council directed this item, their intent was that this adjustment from a 50% to a 75% exemption be done quickly in this miscellaneous code amendments package, but it also came with the direction that they wanted the item studied further, perhaps as part of the sustainability strategic plan update that we have scheduled for work in 2027. And I think Planning Commission talked about that a little bit last time as well. And that's not to, so we kind of have it on our docket as well, though not on the official planning work program yet, that artificial turf will be studied in more depth in the future, regardless of the decision made by the commission tonight or the council in September.
For the purposes of Mr. Yeh, who's here tonight, I mean, I guess it might be a reasonable conclusion that some of the appearance of inconsistency in application of the code might have to do with the timing of when that turf was installed and what the code read at the time in terms of percentage that was exempt or not. But, you know, is there a scenario where, given that this is still something we're trying to figure out as in a go-forward model, that he's not going to be required to tear up his turf at $130,000?
That's really part of the code enforcement action that's happening on the site right now, which I would say isn't in our purview as part of this code amendment.
Commissioner Rosman?
Unless you had any other comments, I would propose a motion to pass the miscellaneous code amendments as written by staff, with the note that the turf will be studied in more depth in the future. Sure. That was a motion, by the way.
Not just a proposal for motion, but
actually. Yes, an actual motion.
Is there a second?
I'll second it. All right.
Any further discussion, or would you like to speak to your motion? Any further?
I think council has a good idea here that let's adjust to 75%. That feels okay with the idea that we'll undertake it in the future to look more closely. I would be okay with also just keeping it at the 50%, but I think there's at least some merit as far as drainage and whatnot that seems like it is kind of a middle area compared to a traditional impervious surface.
Commissioner Nolan?
And I agree with Commissioner Rosman's opinions. I think, you know, I'd be fine with 50%. I think 75% isn't crazy because, again, it does appear to drain far better than, say, like asphalt, for instance. But that's, again, I really would like this studied, especially because it appears to be a growing, a growing thing that is happening. And, you know, it does worry me that there are enough studies that have shown detrimental environmental effects that I'd really like to be aware of what those are, what the trade-offs are, as well as, you know, whether there might be technologies that mitigate those effects before we just say, okay, it's good.
And just as a follow-on to whatever future studies might look like from a practical and logistical perspective, what shape does that take? How does that get executed, and what's the report back out?
It's a great question, Commissioner Medea. At this point, one of our thoughts was that it could be an item that's appropriate to look into with the Sustainability Strategic Plan update. An alternative to that could be that when we look at the Planning Work Program update, we talk about it as a specific line item. I think from the staff perspective, it's clear that there needs to be, I think, some detailed research done into potentially pros and cons of artificial turf installation to be able to bring the commission forward some data about what to do about turf. And as part of that, I think it would also be appropriate to kind of conduct a best case study and look and talk to our neighboring jurisdictions a little bit more. Given the scope of this specific direction, we have not done that research.
And I would also wonder, how much does Kirkland need to do its own research versus if there are consortiums across the region that we could tap into that are doing this together and hopefully drive towards some consistency across the region of what the standard is. Further, I'm wondering, is there any way of, I don't know, trying to think of like moratoriums on installation or on enforcement or, you know, nuances like that that could provide both some grace as well as the flexibility, you know, recognition of the flexibility for considering this more deeply in the future. I don't know if that's something that is even within our, you know, appropriate for us to even discuss. I don't know.
I'd have to revisit our code on what the process is for a moratorium. The city has issued moratoriums in the past.
I don't know if it's like moratorium on enforcement is the thing, or if moratorium is only for like new installations as well, or if even any of this is even something the Planning Commission would advise on at all. I don't know.
I think when it comes to moratoriums, those are typically things that we're talking about with City Council.
Yeah. Sounds good. So if they see that's appropriate, then they can do that. Sounds good. Any further comments on this motion? All right. I will call for the vote then. All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Any opposed? All right. That seems to carry unanimously with the five present.
All right. And then if we could close the hearing.
This is the end of this public hearing on miscellaneous code amendments. And on to the next public hearing.
And then, Mr. Chair, if we could just get you to open this one and then
yes.
We'll take it over.
All right. We now are opening the public hearing on co-living housing, zoning, and municipal code amendments.
All right, thank you, Mr. Chair. So again, we briefed you on this item back in July, and staff has now prepared the code amendments and is prepared to walk you through those tonight. And with you for that item will be our senior planner, Martha, who just got a promotion.
Nice.
Good evening, Commission. I'll be presenting tonight on the co-living housing code amendments to comply with the state House Bill 1998. So the agenda for this evening is first my presentation, where I'll give an overview of the project and review the draft code amendments. And then Planning Commission will receive public testimony on the amendments and then deliberate and, if ready, make a recommendation to City Council. So just a brief overview of the project to remind everyone. Co-living housing is a type of residential use that consists of independent lockable sleeping units for living and sleeping space, and a shared kitchen between the units, and either a shared bathroom or private bathrooms. And our current code allows for a very similar use under residential suites, but it is only permitted in select zones and does not comply with the requirements of the state bill. So it is being removed and replaced with co-living housing with these amendments. So in 2024, Washington State passed House Bill 1998 for co-living housing. The requirements of the bill are that co-living housing must be permitted on any lot that could develop six or more units with the underlying zone. And this includes lots within 1/4 mile walking distance because of the middle housing code allowances. The bill says that co-living units may not count as more than 1/4 of a dwelling unit for calculating density. The bill also sets a parking rate that cities can't have their requirements exceed. The bill says that the review process and development standards for co-living housing may not be any more restrictive than what applies to other residential development. And it says that the affordable housing incentives must be available for co-living housing developments to utilize. And these amendments must be adopted by the end of the year. So staff has recommended a minimum compliance approach with the bill for this code amendment project. But there were some options that we discussed previously on both parking and affordable housing requirements. And these were presented to Planning Commission and to City Council. And both bodies were supportive of implementing the hybrid option for parking to comply with both the House Bill 1998 and with Senate Bill 5184, which is the state's parking bill that cities must comply with by January 2027. and both Planning Commission and City Council were also supportive of exempting co-living housing from affordable housing requirements. So with that direction, staff has drafted code amendments to implement the minimum compliance approach and also the parking and affordable housing options that Planning Commission and Council were supportive of. So I'm going to give a overview of the key amendments, but the full amendments can be found in attachments 1 and 2 to the staff memo for this hearing. The amendments include removing the definition of residential suites, as you can see here in Chapter 5, and adding in the definition of co-living housing. And this new definition is based on the definition provided by the state, with some additions to make it clear that it is a distinct use from other similar uses in the code. The amendments also include a new zoning code chapter, Chapter 111, to contain all of the regulations for co-living housing. This chapter specifies where it can be permitted, which is anywhere that could develop six or more units under the detached, attached, or stacked dwelling unit use types, and also includes the lots within 1/4 of a mile of a major transit stop, as required by the state bill. The chapter also specifies that the review process for co-living developments shall be the same as the process that other residential uses are subject to in the zone, which is required by the state bill. The chapter specifies that co-living units shall count as 1/4 of a dwelling unit for density, where applicable. The new code chapter also sets the parking rate for co-living housing as the hybrid option, so it's compliant with both the House Bill 1998 and Senate Bill 5184. And then it sets all other remaining development standards. It kind of kicks that out to whatever applies to other residential uses in that zone, so the attached, detached, or stacked dwelling unit use. And lastly, it specifies that the affordable housing requirements in Chapter 112 do not apply to co-living housing, but that they may utilize the incentives for affordable housing. The rest of the amendments include cleanup, removing residential suites, that use listing from the chapters that contain it. So that's chapters 30, 45, 50, 55, and 57. Co-living housing will inherently be permitted in all those zones without it being explicitly listed, because the new chapter 111 specifies that it can be permitted wherever six units could be permitted. Chapter 112 has been amended to exempt co-living housing from affordable housing requirements, so the applicability section. And lastly, Title 15 of the Municipal Code has been updated to specify that co-living housing units shall count as one half of the value of a multifamily unit for sewer connection charges, which is a requirement of the bill. So the next steps for this project is to collect public testimony tonight, and then Planning Commission can deliberate and can recommend moving forward to City Council. And then City Council potential adoption is tentatively scheduled for September 16th. And with that, I'll pass it back to Chair Rutherford with questions.
All right, thank you. Any questions from the Commission? Seeing none, I think we're ready to open the public hearing to testimony. So here we open the public hearing for testimony. I see that we have one attending in the audience. If you would like to speak, then please raise your hand now. And we have one who signed in to speak in the audience. So we'll start with Liz Hunt.
Good evening, Liz Hunt, Kirkland resident. Just a couple of quick questions on the co-housing amendment, mostly for clarification. The law would allow, let's say we're talking about a lot that allows six units on that lot, and then the co-housing units would count each unit as a quarter dwelling unit, right? So if you could put 24 co-housing units on a lot that would ordinarily allow six housing units. And so my question is that a correct interpretation of what's going on here? And my other question is, could staff provide an example of how the parking requirements would be calculated? I understand that a co-living unit counts as one quarter of a dwelling unit for density. Does that also factor into the calculation for the parking requirements? So that would be useful to understand. Thank you.
Thank you, Liz. Do we have any other speakers from the public? Seeing none, I will close the public testimony. And we will move on to deliberation. Any commissioners like to start deliberation? Commissioner Nolan?
Mostly, I'm just excited about being able to expand co-housing, and I think that all of the plans are great. I also like the decision to remove the affordability requirements while also allowing it to tap into funding for affordability, because again, these are some of the most affordable housing out there. So I think from an affordability perspective, we should be encouraging them.
Yes. Commissioner Rosman.
Do we want to have staff answer the questions on density and parking?
Yeah, I can answer those. So on the density question, the calculations are correct. So if a lot could develop six units based on the underlying zone, because co-living units are counted as a quarter unit for density, they could develop 24 co-living units. And co-living units are essentially just a bedroom, so they aren't full, like, units, apartments, or anything. And then for the parking, for the draft code, each co-living unit shall count, or is just one unit in terms of calculating parking. So the quarter unit only applies to the density. It doesn't apply to parking.
I guess I will say, though, 5184 would exempt them generally because they're small enough from a minimum parking requirement, just to be fully transparent about what that actually means. Yeah. The slide is great. Thanks.
Yeah. So, yeah, likely most or all of the units would be less than 1,200 square feet. So under 5184, zero parking spaces would be required.
Any further comments from the commission? Would anyone like to make a motion?
Sure.
All right.
I move that we adopt the co-living housing as proposed.
I second it.
All right. Any further discussion? All right. All those in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? That appears to be a unanimous approval of the five present. All right. And with that, we close this public hearing. And we're on to the next item on the agenda, which is reading and approval of minutes. I see no minutes at this time, so... The next item is administrative reports and planning commission discussion. Go ahead.
All right, thank you, Mr. Chair. So just a quick calendar update. We actually do not have any items set for your September 11th meeting. So unless we hear any objections, we plan to cancel the September 11th meeting of the planning commission. And your next meeting would be September 25th. That will be a good one because we do plan, as they all are, right? But we do plan to bring you draft code amendments for all of the critical area ordinance update. We want to make sure that you get a lot of time with those so that you get a good look at the draft code amendments before we're taking them to public hearing. So that will be for Chapter 90, Wetlands and Streams, and Chapter 85, Geohazards. And then following that, October 9th is tentatively when we're aiming to hold the public hearing for the critical area ordinance update, but we've also held October 23rd in case you feel like you want a little bit more time with those. So your next several meetings are going to be really focused on the critical area ordinance update, and would just encourage commissioners, reach out if you have questions about that. We'll obviously be talking here, but one-on-one, if you have any questions, feel free. And then lastly, just one more administrative note, which is that council is holding interviews for the vacant planning commissioner position on September 9th, which means that if someone is selected, they would formally appoint them at their September 16th meeting. So the first, at your next regularly scheduled meeting, we may have a 7th planning commissioner. And that's it for me, Mr. Chair.
Great. Any other points of discussion from others on the commission? All right. Seeing none, we are on to our penultimate item on the agenda, comments from the audience. Is there anyone who would like to speak to the commission before we adjourn? Seeing none, we've reached the end of our agenda, and this meeting of the Planning Commission is adjourned.